Hi, this is Paul, and it's Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through my sermon in anticipation of Sunday. I didn't get a YouTube copy of my sermon last week. I sometimes forget to hit the record button on my camera, and then I go through the whole sermon and I don't have the final draft recorded. But you can always catch my sermons or my Sunday school classes when I forget to record them and post them on YouTube. They're always on the church Facebook page. So that's Livingstone's Christian Reformed Church in Sacramento, California. So if you're curious about the final draft, the copy of the service on Facebook has music and everything. The copy I usually post to the church YouTube just has the sermon. The Sunday school class is the same in both senses. It's just me for an hour. Now, Americans have a very special relationship with taxes, and this is partly because of how America began. Now, the great tax revolt that became the American Revolution started, in a sense, because the British were trying to recoup some of the money that the British Empire paid for the French and Indian War. Now, the French and Indian War was really a world war against France, and you can find YouTubes about that. It's quite interesting. And so they had the stamp tax and the paper tax and the tea tax and all these kinds of things, and the Americans were quite annoyed by this because they didn't have a voice, hence no taxation without representation. Now, on the British side, they were a little annoyed by this because they felt that here we had sent these troops to the United States to protect them from the French and the Indian in that war, and now they're not willing to pay for it. They're not willing to pay their own way. So what you had happen is not an uncommon dynamic that happens with troops that were in one moment seen as allies and protectors, pretty soon became viewed as an occupational force, and suddenly the sentiments turned very quickly away from that, and the American Revolution was the American Revolution. Now, the Romans had interesting ideas with respect to taxes. Romans believed that the people that they conquered should pay their taxes. And Rome, if you were a Roman citizen living in Rome, you didn't pay taxes, even though half the people living in Rome were slaves. So the Roman Empire lived on the taxes of the people that they conquered. Well, how do you get money? You know, it's one thing to, when you send your army in to basically just grab the wealth out of a city that you conquer. But how do you, on an ongoing basis, are you able to continually pay taxes? Because here's the thing. If you're a foreigner, you don't know the people. You don't know who has the money. You don't know how they can hide it. You don't know all the individual ways. So how do you get money out of 1,000 small places when you're a foreigner? Well, you hire a local who knows who has the money, and with the backing of your occupational army, and you get them to cough it up. Now, how do you maximize revenues? Well, actually, most people who will do this kind of thing will not be obviously loved by their people. And, well, you maximize revenues by incentivizing the tax collectors. And how do you incentivize the tax collectors? Well, you can have competitive bidding. And this all becomes the practice of tax farming. And so what happened was that Hebrew individuals would go to the Romans, and the Romans would say, we'd need this much tax, and they could bid against each other. Well, I'll raise this much for you. But what everybody understands is that if you have to pay 10,000 shekels to Rome, if you can, with the backing of the Roman army, get 15,000 or 20,000 shekels out of your neighbors, well, then you get to keep 10. And so actually being a tax collector was a very lucrative business. It also meant that in Galilee and Judea, tax collectors were hated because they were seen as traitors and turncoats against the Roman occupational army. You have to ask, well, who's going to go into such a profession? Well, probably the same population that's going to go into prostitute. These are people of low status among their own people. Their prospects aren't great, and they know it. The only thing they can really trade on is the common knowledge that you have growing up within a society. But you have to betray your mother tongue and your native people and your brothers and sisters, your national and ethnic brothers and sisters, in order to get there. And, well, you make your way by collaborating with the occupying army. and you will be hated by your own people, but you had little to lose anyway, and you have a great deal to gain by being a traitor, which is why people do these kinds of things. And in prostitution, similar thing. It's usually not women who have options that turn to prostitution. It's women who have few options, and here is one way that at great cost to their dignity and their health and many other things, they can in fact make enough money to live. Now, what the Hebrew leaders saw in this and the religious leaders saw, now religious lines very much traveled along ethnic lines in that day, was the corruption of God's people. And we should basically, the definition of corruption is do of anti-corruption is do what is right, not what is expedient. And when I lived in the Dominican Republic, the president of the country, Balaguer, at one point, in fact, told the army and police, who pretty much just did their service within the country, that we know we can't pay you so much and that you'll have to make up the difference between what it takes to live and what you and what we're paying you basically on tips from the people. Well, if you're police officers and your army that's doing immigration patrol and other kinds of police things, if they are making their money off tips, well, it's pretty much a surefire formula for corruption. And but now corruption scales, and what corruption really deals with is this inner strength of integrity, to be able to say no to yourself, to be able to say no to some basic impulses that you have within yourself. And this, in fact, as it scales up, is the backbone of a healthy society. And so the religious leaders of the Hebrews were by no means off base in terms of trying to encourage a society to have integrity, to be able to resist not only the Roman occupation out of nationalist reasons, but to resist the common kinds of corruptions that tempt us all. And for us today, that might be the temptation of a bowl of ice cream. It might be the temptation of somebody else's wife or husband. It might be the temptation of money, or all kinds of ways that we are tempted to do what is expedient and not what is right. Now, corruption is a terribly difficult thing to reverse once it really gets set into a culture. And you can see this all around the world. You can find it in Latin America, you can find it in Africa, you can find it in Asia, you can find it in Europe. Now, of course, it's here too, but the level of corruption so often differs, and that has a great deal to do with the culture of the country and this sense of inner strength and of integrity. Now, the Jews had practiced a lot of inner strength and integrity over a very long time. And in fact, the entire war to not worship the Baals and foreign gods and the gods of her neighbors, this was all in some ways an exercise in inner integrity, because worshiping other gods is expedient if you want to find favor spiritually or you want to find favor socially. And so actually a lot of the stories in the Old Testament that deal with worshiping the Lord alone as opposed to all the other gods and all the things that came with all the other gods, these kinds of things built into the people moral fiber. And during the exile, for which Hebrew Israelite and Hebrew identity, as opposed to those who had conquered them, this then becomes an existential crisis for the identity of the people. And quite remarkably, the Jews maintain themselves through centuries of occupation and subjugation and attempts at integrating them into just the massive patchwork of nations of the world. And one of the amazing things about the story of the Jewish people is that they continue to be an identifiable people. That requires incredible resolve, incredible inner strength, and incredible fortitude. Sexual license is expedient. If you are a Roman freedom meant basically having sex with anyone or anything at any time in any place. That's and and having the power to do so. That was the libido dominante in terms of the Roman Empire that Augustine in City of God really railed against. And so the Jewish leaders saw the Roman occupation as contamination. Not only was it an affront to them in terms of their nationhood, but it was an existential threat, particularly, of course, to the youth, who are always most susceptible to these kinds of things, but that this was a very big deal. And we should be able to understand the importance of the culture war waged by the Jewish leaders of their time. And it, in fact, was a culture war. Religious conservatives were applying social pressure on their neighbors to hold the line. Now, in almost any sort of ancient warfare, your side would win if all of the soldiers in the battle line could keep their courage and stand and not break and run. That's really where that hold the line metaphor comes from. And well, how do you keep people from doing what is right instead of what is expedient, and doing what is right instead of what is corrupt? It was national pride to resist foreign pagan occupation, and the stories of the Maccabean revolt against the Greeks continue to ring on. And those are in those apocryphal books that are in some Bibles. You can find the fatter Bibles, you can find those in the middle. And the great stories of Jewish nationals standing up against Antiochus Epiphanes and the occupational forces of the Greeks, and very much part of the way that you can rally people through pride and through enthusiasm and through national identity is to say, hey, we're Jews, we're going to stand up against the Romans. And, you know, don't become a tax collector. Don't let your daughters get into prostitution. Starve before then. Be in prison before then. Kill before then. And so what you have actually in the first century culture war, because they didn't have many military options, and in fact, every military option that was tried, and many of them were tried in terms of revolting against the Romans, one of the biggest ones in 70 AD, where the Second Temple was destroyed, is you had virtue signaling, and virtue signaling by religious observance. And generally speaking, the religious boundary markers had to do with sex, had to do with food, had to do with Sabbath, had to do with keeping the law. And now, in order to do this, and in order to fulfill these, to hedge the Torah and fulfill the covenant of the Old Testament in the midst of occupation, you keep contact with foreigners at a minimum, which is exactly why prostitutes and tax collectors were, in Jesus' day, always seen as, in their own way, unclean. They were unclean by contact and association, and in the case of prostitution, literally getting into bed with the Romans. Now, surely Jesus would line up with God's people. Surely Jesus wants us to build up our character. Surely Jesus wants us to have integrity. In fact, if you read the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus places a very high bar on integrity. You've got national, ethnic, and religious tribal pride is a powerful motivation to get people to hold the line, to comply, to do what is right, to do what is in the long-term interest of their people and of their nation, and not what is expedient. Why not use this motivation as a hedge against the corruption of Jewish men and Jewish girls by Roman money? Is Jesus soft on sex trafficking? Now, in Mark chapter 2, verse 13, which is where we're up to in the Gospels, Jesus went again besides the sea. And if you've been following my sermons, you know that this is not just a detail about location that is incidental to the story. The sea is this area of chaos. Now, this is why he recruits fishermen, because fishermen are men who go out into the sea and bring life out of the realm of chaos. And when Jesus says, I will make you fishers of people, because in English, fish is part of fishermen, that wasn't the case in Greek. Jesus basically is saying, I'm going to make you catchers or hunters of people. And so what Jesus is doing here, the reason that Mark mentions he's by the sea, again, it's not just an incidental geographical point. Jesus is going back into the realm of chaos. And remember, the sea that we saw a couple Sundays ago was the Sea of Capernaum. All right. So Jesus again went by the sea. Again, he's going back into the crowd, into the mob, and a whole crowd gathered around him, and he taught them. He's starting to penetrate their thinking. He's starting to penetrate their consciousness. They're listening to him. And now what we see in the Gospel of Mark and the other Gospels is that the crowd, as a crowd, they often don't get it, because mobs very often do what is expedient to whatever zeitgeist or spirit inhabits that mob, but they're listening to Jesus, and they're working it through, and they're trying to figure it out. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth. Now, Levi is exactly one of these tax farmers, or at least working for one of these tax farmers. He might not even be a top guy, because of course you delegate on down. You can understand how economics and business works. And Jesus says to him, follow me. And he got up and followed him that quick. Now, again, Jesus is hunting people. And surely it would have been popular for the people. Look, he's won. Jesus has delivered someone from the heinous occupation of collaborating with the Romans. And what might have Levi's motivation have been? Maybe now he sees Jesus, who is a celebrity, he's high status conferred on him by the attention of the crowd. And maybe now there's an opportunity for renewed acceptance by his countrymen. And so one way of reading this is very much along the nationalist lines of Jesus' culture war, that woohoo, Jesus has won one. He's abandoned the toll booth. This should garner Jesus' approval from nationalists and the religious conservatives. But the story goes on. And Jesus was having a meal in Levi's house. Okay, well, how did Levi get that nice house? Probably at the expense of trading in his insider national knowledge to turncoat and grab money for the Romans and keep a nice share for himself. And who does Levi, well, who are his friends? Well, who are the friends of a traitor? Who are the friends of prostitutes? Well, it's the people that they're in bed with. It's the other tax collectors. It's the other prostitutes. It's the other sinners. And so Jesus goes there, and now suddenly everyone's got mixed feelings because they know about corruption. See, this whole system of clean and unclean is all about corruption. And if you have teenage children or young children, you look very carefully at the friends of your children, because you know it's easier to slide downhill than to climb up. And so here Jesus is eating with these people. And eating risks ceremonial uncleanliness, because again, they are always with the Romans, and they start to get the taste of the Roman food, and they start to get the habits of the Romans in terms of their sexual habits and their entertainment habits and all the habits. And is Jesus sliding downhill? And suddenly we begin to realize that Jesus is, oh my, a lot of these people are really liking Jesus. Well, what side is Jesus on then, really? Because in our low-resolution way, this is how we figure things out. We begin to look around and we say, well, if he's friends with him, if all these people are listening to him, well, he must be there. He must be alt-right or alt-left or alt-right adjacent or alt-left adjacent or on and on and on and on. This language and this nomenclature just keeps coming up. One empty tax booth is good. But what happens if Jesus seems popular among the crowd of corrupt Roman collaborators? Maybe Jesus is soft on Rome, and soft on the Roman occupation, and soft on the sex trafficking, and soft on the corruption of God's people. Maybe Jesus is a traitor. If Jesus shows signs of not holding the line in the culture war and he's getting very popular, pretty soon he's going to be an unsafe influence. There's going to be dog whistles and there's going to be coded texts and there's going to be all of this stuff. And if you're paying attention to the culture war and the speed at which it travels over social media, you can see and know how this stuff works, right? Have all these low resolution associations. Have you ever seen a kid with a more punchable face? Look into the Covington Boys, that whole episode about social media. Would Jesus have a Black Lives Matter sign? Would Jesus wear a MAGA hat? Maybe it would be Make Israel Great Again. The higher the stakes, the more the bloodshed, the faster, the quicker the judgment. When the experts of the law and the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, okay, now they're playing the social pressure game. Jesus is getting a little too high status, is a little too hard to grab a hold of. Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? What kind of guy are you following? Should you really be following him? How do you know he's not contaminating the cause? How do you know he's not weakening the line? How do you know? Look at all the stories in Mark up until now. Look at Jesus and the unclean. He delivers a man from an unclean spirit from the synagogue. Jesus delivers a woman from a fever by touching her. See, in every case where Jesus is supposed to be contaminated, Jesus doesn't get contaminated. He makes the people he touches and speaks to clean. He delivers a leper from his unclean disease by touching him. He forgives the paralytic sin and sends him away walking. Jesus eating with sinners and tax collectors. Everyone thinks it's going to make him unclean. Jesus is going to slide downhill on that slippery slope. Oh, Jesus is going to carry his cross uphill, my friends. Whoops. When Jesus heard this, he said to them, "Those who are healthy don't need a physician, but those who are sick do. I have come not to call the righteous, but the sinners." Now, right here, we see Jesus as his most problematic, because I think in our contemporary situation, many would say, are you calling me a sinner? Are you calling me unclean? Are you calling me healthy? I am my own. I am good in just as I am. I don't need any improvement. It's up to the world to adjust to me and to recognize my greatness. Jesus says, go ahead. You don't need me. Don't pay any attention to me. You're already righteous. You go be righteous. I'm going to pay attention to sinners. Do you take offense at him calling you a sinner? Do you deny that entire framework? Now, a number of years ago, and Mark Maron has done so many podcasts, I have not a hope of finding it. But I remember one podcast, especially in his early days, Mark Maron talked a lot about sobriety. And he noted that celebrities always fall victim to themselves. Because suddenly you're in your 20s, and now suddenly you have, you know, all the money in the world, and every possible temptation comes your way, and they so often get lost in alcohol and drugs and sex, and they can't have stable relationships, and their lives are a mess, and it's completely understandable. And so Mark Maron noted that, you know, a lot at some point, either they get sober or they don't, and a lot get sober. But then he noticed the celebrities that turn Christian, and sometimes weird Christian and wacky Christian and really serious Christian. And I remember Mark Maron's observation is, it's the really bad addicts that have to go all the way to Christianity to maintain their sobriety. They have to go all the way to that crazy religion that says no to all sorts of things, because that's the only stuff that can keep them sober. Now, what does that mean if you're a Christian? What does that say about us? That we're weak inside? That we're so far gone, we need someone as strong as the Son of God to come from heaven and help us because we can't make it on our own? Yeah, that's exactly what that means. Now flip this around. What won't Jesus risk to seek the lost? Will he risk being associated with the other political side? Yes. Will he risk rejection by his own tribe? And how many times does he say, I came for Israel. Oh, Jesus, go over there. Nope, my mission is with Israel. Paul will go to the Gentiles. Jesus is going to stay with Israel. And he's going to be killed for it. Because in the midst of the first century culture war, the Romans and the religious conservatives couldn't agree on anything. But in the end, they cut a deal. And what deal did they cut? Jesus is better off dead. We don't want him around here. We don't want him talking like he does and living as he is. We don't want him crossing these lines that we've drawn. Because both of us in our culture war are committed to this line. And Jesus says, I will cross any line. If I can come from heaven to earth, I'll cross your little line in a heartbeat. Your little line? No. No. He will take this all the way, not only to damage his financial prospects, his status, and even his life. Can you keep your pride in your soul? If the choice is having Jesus and recognizing you're a sinner, will you do that? Or do you just want to keep your pride? Jesus knew the book of Deuteronomy. If a person commits a sin punishable by death and is executed, and you hang the corpse on a tree, his body must not remain all night on the tree. Instead, you must make certain you bury him that same day. For the one who is left exposed on a tree is cursed by God. You must not defile your land, which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. For all who... Now, Paul picks this up in Galatians 10. And Paul's got a very complicated conversation about the law, because it's a difficult thing to suss out this business in a culture war of moral strength and character, and we want that, and we need that, and in fact, to live the Christian life, you need to pursue that, and in fact, to live the Christian life, you need to achieve that to a degree. And so there's the law, and you need the law, but yet at the same time, if you live by the law then becomes your master. And Paul gets into this with the Galatians. For all who rely on doing the works of the law are under a curse. Because it is written, cursed is everyone who does not keep on doing everything written in the book of the law. Now it is clear no one is justified by God for fulfilling the law. In other words, mere legalism isn't actually the kind of love Jesus is showing. But love yields strength and character and order and goodness. But it's very hard to codify into rules. And in fact, if your goal is merely rules, the rules will probably be a proxy for pride or other things. And God says, no, there can be no proxy. It must be love of God and love of neighbor. That's the heart of the law. And the codes may change, and codes might help us and help us to figure out where boundaries are and what we should and shouldn't do. But again, Jesus will cross any line in order to show where the real lines are. Because the righteous will live by faith, Book of Habakkuk. But the law is not based on faith. But the one who does the works of the law will live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. Because it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. In Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham would come to the Gentiles, so that we could receive the Spirit, the promise of the Spirit by faith. Jesus didn't eat with the corrupt to validate corruption. Jesus demonstrated that there was corruption, which is at heart self-salvationism, among the nationalists as well. They all need the doctor. None of them was getting out of their culture war alive. And neither are you. So what will you do? On Netflix, you can find a documentary, Accidental Courtesy. And NPR picked this up. Daryl Davis was a jazz singer. And he made money as a jazz singer. He had a good career. And somewhere along the line, he decided his war on the Klan would be a war of love. And so he would befriend members of the Klan. And what did he discover? A lot of the people in the Klan were like a lot of tax collectors. They're people of low status, people who didn't have any option. So they grabbed a certain banner in order to find some identity. They could find identity in hatred of another race. They could find identity in wearing hoods and burning crosses. And, well, there are many Klansmen today. They're small time. The law is real, and so they skirt the law. But Daryl, what does Daryl do? There's one point in the documentary when he tells the story that the Klan, nobody will rent them a bus. Nobody wants to rent the Klan a bus. Why? Because every time they rent a bus, they go into a neighborhood, they do a march in somebody's neighborhood, everybody in the neighborhood throws rocks at them, so the bus comes back damaged. What does Daryl say? You can use my bus. I have one. The Klansman's like, wait, you're a black guy. You're going to let us use your bus to do our rally. And Daryl says, yeah, just put some gas in it when you're done with it. Well, how does he love them out of their robes? Who are his critics? And another poignant place in the documentary, you can guess who really goes after Daryl Davis. It's the people that say, you're betraying your race. Daryl says, and there's one race, baby. It's the human race. He is no fool if he would choose to give the things he cannot keep to buy what he can never lose. It's the truth.